Good morning and welcome to the Talking Information Center. Today is Sunday, February 22nd, and we have today's reading of the Boston Herald being read to you by William. Good morning, William.
Good morning, Billy, and good morning, listeners, to the Talking Information Center's reading of the Boston Sunday Herald for February 22nd, 2026. We begin with a story about communist and socialist Democrats in the political winds they create. A Tale of Two Cities and Taxes. The reality of running a big city is hitting two mayors, Michelle Wu and socialist Zohran Mamdani, as they face businesses fleeing their cities while walloping taxpayers with huge tax hikes rather than cutting their ballooning budgets. Mayor Wu issued an ultimatum to Massachusetts lawmakers to approve her commercial tax hike or hit Boston property tax owners with 13% hikes. Her strategy failed miserably as lawmakers refused to give in to her demands. In New York, Mamdani issued a nearly identical ultimatum to state lawmakers to approve his proposal to hike taxes on the wealthy and corporations. He will hit residents with a 9.5% property tax increase if state lawmakers rebuff his demands. After years of fiscal mismanagement, we're staring at a $5.4 billion budget gap in two paths, the rookie New York City mayor posted on X. One, Albany can raise taxes on the ultra-wealthy and the most profitable corporations and addresses the fiscal imbalance between our city and state. The other, a last resort, balance the budget on the backs of working people using the only tools at the city's disposal. Mamdani's demands don't seem to be moving lawmakers either, bursting his socialist bubble. It means even more New York City residents and businesses will be fleeing the regime to avoid the huge tax hikes. Both Mamdani and Mayor Wu in Boston are blaming state lawmakers for their fiscal problems rather than compromise or changing their tactics. Mayor Wu has gone so far as to punish her opponents in the state Senate by running candidates against them. The end result is that both socialist icons will be passing on multi-billion-dollar massive tax hikes to middle-class people they promised to help in their campaigns. Mayor Wu is also facing an alarming decline in commercial property values in downtown Boston, which is taking a huge toll on the $4.8 billion budget, which is financed through property taxes. But she stubbornly refuses to cut her budget to prevent the tax hikes, instead adding scores of diversity positions. Her budget has grown 26% over the last 4 years, from $3.8 billion to $4.8 billion. Mamdani is cutting about 5,000 officer positions in the New York City Police Department to pay for his expensive socialist and diversity programs. His $127 billion spending plan includes $5.6 million a year for the Office of Racial Equity and $4.6 million for the similarly named Commission on Racial Equity. He is also paying for a number of high-level diversity and inclusion positions throughout his administration and $835,000 a year for the Commission on Gender Equity. Mayor Wu, in contrast to Mamdani, has not gone so far as to whack her police department budget. But, like Mamdani, her tax hikes and anti-business policies are causing hundreds of businesses to cut jobs or move out of the city entirely. And the number of children living in the city has dropped precipitously by about 10,000 in the last 15 years. In New York City, thousands of jobs are leaving to states like Texas and low taxes and more business-friendly policies. Mondami has proposed increasing New York City's corporate tax rate from 7.25% to a whopping 11.5%, and that is likely to worsen the exodus. End of article. Some people are getting a free ride. Mayor Wu extends fare free MBTA bus pilot by Gayla Cawley. Boston's Mayor Michelle Wu said the city will spend another $1 million in federal funds to extend a fare-free MBTA bus pilot for 3 more months. Wu said yesterday that the city will be using its remaining American Rescue Plan Act dollars at a rate of $340,000 per month to extend a fare-free pilot program for MBTA bus routes number 23, number 28, and number 29 through the end of June. Based on a monthly reimbursement rate to the MBTA, this program has cost the city about $17.34 million in ARPA funds to waive fares for riders on bus routes that serve Dorchester, Mattapan, and Roxbury. Since it was launched in March of 2022. Initially envisioned as a 2-year pilot, the Wu administration extended the program for 2 years in February of 2024, and now for another 3 months ahead of its anticipated expiration at the end of this month. The city of Boston is in talks with the MBTA about how to keep the fare-free program for these sections of town in place for the long term, the mayor's office said. Fare-free bus service helps families in these areas, workers and businesses, and also makes bus service faster and more reliable, Mayor Wu said in a statement. We are extending this program through June as we look to work with the MBTA to keep this going. The mayor's office said ridership increased by 35% on the 3 fare-free routes in the first year of the pilot program, which is more than twice what the MBTA's average is. The targeted routes have seen a 16% spike in ridership since before the pandemic. Surveys conducted by the city have shown more than a quarter of riders using those routes have saved at least $20 a month, which they have reported putting towards other household expenses like groceries, medicine, rent, or school supplies, the mayor's office said. Other survey respondents reported that fare-free bus transportation has helped them build emergency funds, cover school expenses, or simply stay in their homes, the mayor's office said. Interim Transportation Secretary and MBTA General Manager Philip Eng said Friday that the T has been pleased to be able to support the city's free fare bus pilot program, but gave no indication of whether it would be extended beyond June. End of article. In our next article, under the heading of State House Fraud, the Department of Transitional Assistance names a new commissioner. It comes amid the SNAP fraud cases by Tim Dunn. Acting Department of Transitional Assistance, DTA Director Michael Cole, has been appointed as the agency's official head, effective immediately, as a flurry of SNAP EBT card fraud schemes have been uncovered in Massachusetts just days after the Herald published a DTA whistleblower's account of rampant fraud within the program. I am pleased to share with you that Michael Cole has been appointed Commissioner of the Department of Transitional Assistance, effective immediately. As you know, Michael has served as Acting Commissioner since September of 2025, after more than a decade of service to DTA and other roles, said Health and Human Services Secretary Dr. Kemi Mahania on Thursday in an agency-wide email obtained by the Herald. We are grateful for his continued leadership and know that his incredible depth of knowledge within the agency and compassion for the people we serve will position DTA well to meet the critical moment in our shared work. Please join me in thanking Michael for his continued service to the DTA, he said. Cole's appointment comes just days after the Boston Herald detailed a whistleblower's account of rampant fraud in the state's SNAP benefits program and lackluster efforts to combat the fraud in the DTA. It also follows multiple SNAP and other public benefit fraud busts by the United States Attorney's Office and the State Auditor's Office. Cole has served as acting commissioner of the DTA since September, following the retirement of former commissioner Jeff McHugh. In the press release announcing Cole's appointment, the DTA credited him with guiding the agency through the recent suspension of the SNAP program during the federal government shutdown by the Democrats, and for leading the DTA through federal changes to the program under President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill. DTA is going through a critical time, fulfilling the agency's extremely important role as our state's top defense against food insecurity while adapting to major federal pressures, said Secretary Mahania in the public statement. Michael's incredible depth of knowledge of the agency and his ability to manage its operational needs, plus his strong relationship with DTA's partners and deep compassion for the people we serve, make him the right leader of the Department of Transitional Assistance to meet this moment. In December, the feds busted an alleged $7 million SNAP fraud scheme run by two Haitian men. In January, the U.S. Attorney's Office announced another SNAP fraud bust, a $1 million scheme allegedly run by a naturalized U.S. citizen from the Dominican Republic, two illegal immigrants, and one green card holder. Meanwhile, the state's auditors, Bureau of Special Investigation, or BSI, has identified over $34 million in public benefit fraud in fiscal year 23, 24, and 25, with SNAP representing the largest share of fraud in each year. BSI also reported that 82.9% of all referrals processed by the office in fiscal year 24 involved SNAP, while 78% of referrals processed in fiscal year 25 involved SNAP. The BSI has also found that in fiscal year 23, 24, and 25, a significant share of the detected fraud was tied to Department of Transitional Assistance programs. In fiscal year 23, a whopping 69% of identified fraud was tied to the Department of Transitional Assistance programs, totaling $8.49 million. The figure dropped, but was still high in fiscal year 24, with Department of Transitional Assistance programs tied to 59% of identified fraud. Good for $6.02 million. In fiscal year 25, identified fraud tied to the Department of Transitional Assistance programs dropped again, yet still remained high, making up 49% or $4.95 million. The state Senate's Republican caucus is calling for an oversight hearing on SNAP EBT fraud in Massachusetts after the Herald reported the account of a whistleblower in the Department of Transitional Assistance and the rampant fraud within the SNAP EBT program and the DTA's lackluster efforts in stopping it. This all as Governor Maura Healey continues to refuse to turn over information on Massachusetts SNAP recipients, including immigration status, to the Trump administration and the U.S. Department of Agriculture to root out waste, fraud, and abuse. Healey says that President Trump has not provided her office any assurances that the information will not be handed over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And why not? I am grateful for the opportunity to build on the foundation laid by former Commissioner McHugh and lead DTA through this particularly challenging time for the Department of Transitional Assistance, said Cole. We have a lot of work to do to implement recent federal changes, but the Department of Transitional Assistance staff at every level are the most skilled, compassionate, and innovative colleagues anyone could ask for. I am confident that this national moment, the Department of Transitional Assistance will personify excellence in public service and deliver proudly for the many people of Massachusetts who rely on SNAP. The DTA's press release also featured statements in support of Cole and the troubling agency from several state lawmakers and the leaders of nonprofit organizations. All of these additional statements included clear criticism of the federal government and recent changes to the SNAP program under the Trump administration, while failing to mention the recent fraud uncovered in Massachusetts. Healey's office and the Department of Transitional Assistance declined to comment on whether Cole's appointment is related to the recently uncovered SNAP fraud schemes and the Herald's whistleblower reports. End of article. This next article is under crime in the Massachusetts State Police. Civil rights claim planned in fatal crash involving Massachusetts State Police Sergeant. Attorneys for Sergeant Scott Quigley's alleged intoxication, information delays point to a farce of an investigation and possible cover-up by Aaron Curtis. Woburn, Massachusetts, the family of a special needs man who died after a December 2023 crash caused by State Police Sergeant Scott Quigley, is preparing to expand their wrongful death lawsuit to include civil rights violations. Attorney Mike Mahoney, who represents Lynn Shinetto, the mother of 37-year-old Angelo Shinetto, said state police supervisors not only withheld information about the head-on crash in Woburn, in which Quigley was allegedly driving nearly twice the speed limit and under the influence, but also misled the family about the status of the investigation. A report from the Disabled Persons Protection Commission states that Angelo Shinetto, a paraplegic man formerly from Saugus, was riding in a van on his way home from a medical appointment when the head-on crash occurred. According to the document, Shinetto suffered internal injuries and developed sepsis. Given the extent of his injuries and his prognosis, the report states that the decision was made to pursue comfort-focused care. He was removed from life support on January 11th of 2024, and he died on January 13th of 2024, about a month after the crash. The initial lawsuit states that before his death, Angelo experienced great pain of body and anguish of mind, resulting in conscious pain and suffering prior to his death. Delays missing the investigative steps. Mahoney said that when attorneys sought information about the wreck, the state police supervisors told them that the investigation was still active, only to discover, once the documents were released, that the last notation in the file had been made 6 months earlier and that Quigley's medical records had not been reviewed. According to Mahoney, the crash report stated that Quigley was found to be only partially at fault and labeled the incident as a medical situation without specifying what the medical issue was. In a motion to compel discovery, attorneys pointed out that Quigley himself reported having no memory of the crash, saying, "It appears I may have fallen asleep at the wheel," and that immediately prior, he felt extremely fatigued and lightheaded. As the case has progressed, however, hospital records have come to light that suggest Quigley's blood alcohol content was 0.11 above the legal limit of 0.08. It seems they were just delaying the release of the crash information, Mahoney said. Mahoney said that it took 13 months before attorneys received any meaningful records from the Massachusetts State Police, which he described as an unusually long delay given the severity of the crash and the fact that a death was involved. He also pointed out that the Massachusetts State Police never conducted an accident reconstruction, a standard step in serious injury collisions. And Massachusetts State Police Lieutenant Jennifer Penton, the crash investigator, did not interview Quigley until 8 days after the crash. We know now there wasn't an investigation. It was a farce, Mahoney said. When asked whether he believes the omissions amounted to a cover-up, Mahoney said, "It's looking like that, yeah." "In walking like a duck, yep, for sure," he said. Fight over medical records. Mahoney said that because the Massachusetts State Police were delaying the release of the crash information, the initial lawsuit was filed against Bridgewell, Inc., the Peabody-based nonprofit whose wheelchair-accessible van Angelo was riding in when the crash occurred. In a third-party complaint, Bridgewell argued that its driver was operating properly at about 5 p.m. on December 12, 2023, when Quigley's cruiser suddenly drove from its lane of traffic across the double yellow line into the Bridgewell driver's lane of traffic and caused the collision. In addition to Angelo's death, the van driver was hospitalized. Quigley also suffered serious injuries and was taken to Lahey Hospital and Medical Center in Burlington. According to court records, he's sustained trauma to his liver and kidney, an open abdominal wound, and fractured left hip socket. He was released from the Lahey Hospital on December 16th of 2023. Bridgewell subpoenaed Quigley's medical records from Lahey Hospital. The hospital initially produced the records with the toxicology results redacted, prompting Bridgewell to file a second motion to compel the unredacted records. The attorney opposed Bridgewell's request, arguing that toxicology results were irrelevant to the civil case and should remain private. The filing stated that his laboratory results will shed no further light on liability or damages, and that releasing them would result in invasion of the non-party's privacy for no legitimate purpose. The opposition also acknowledged that liability for the crash was not in dispute, stating, "There is no reasonable view of the facts in which the Massachusetts State Police will not be liable for the plaintiff's damages, as they owned and were responsible for the operation of the vehicle." On January 20th, however, an Essex Superior Court judge ordered the complete unredacted toxicology results to be turned over. Revelations surfaced during the murder retrial. The bombshell revelations about Quigley's crash were brought to the surface because of a retrial of the Fan brothers for a 2020 Lowell murder. Quigley had been a key investigator in that case, in which brothers Billy Fan and Balu Fan and Chena Fan were accused of gunning down 22-year-old Tyrone Fett outside his Lowell home on September 14th of 2020. The Fan brothers' defense team, composed of attorneys William Dolan, Lorenzo Perez, and Mark Wester, sought discovery from the Middlesex District Attorney's Office, which ultimately led them to disclose the crash-related information. The state police subsequently suspended Quigley without pay. The Middlesex District Attorney's Office, where Quigley worked as a homicide investigator, then referred the matter to the Suffolk County District Attorney for review of possible criminal charges. The defense attorney has since sought for the first-degree murder charges pending against the Fan brothers to be dismissed, arguing that the circumstances surrounding Quigley's crash call into question the integrity of his investigative work. In the meantime, the defense attorneys filed a motion requesting that evidentiary hearing to determine whether the state police withheld information or engaged in misconduct that would undermine the prosecution's case. The filing submitted in Middlesex Superior Court asked to subpoena 19 current and former law enforcement officers, including Quigley and Penton, to testify under oath about how the Woburn crash was handled. Prosecutors initially had until Friday to respond to the defense's motion, but Dolan, representing Chanup Phan, said shortly after 5 p.m. that Judge Chris Barry-Smith had granted more time for them to file their response. My client is frustrated because we are asking for bail after that hearing, Dolan said. This is just more of the same dragging of their feet. Longing for peace. Mahoney said the lawsuit, as it currently stands, falls between the Massachusetts Tort Claims Act, which caps damages against public employees acting within the scope of their duties, at $100,000. What is Angelo's life worth? Mahoney said. It's recently more than $100,000. With a toxicology report suggesting Quigley's blood alcohol content at 0.11, Mahoney said it raises critical questions such as, where was he drinking? And what was his drinking on the job? He said that if Quigley was acting outside the scope of his duties at the time of the crash, and if other officers impeded or mishandled the investigation, it could amount to a violation of Angelo's civil rights. That, he said, is why he plans to expand the lawsuit to include a civil rights claim. Mahoney referenced a comment Lynn Shinetto made during a televised interview. Quote, if that was you or me, we would be in jail, unquote. That was her son. That was her purpose, Mahoney said about Lynn. This has left quite a void, especially in the way that it happened. This woman is just looking for some peace, he added, and she's not going to have it that until we find out exactly what happened that day. Quigley's criminal defense attorney, Christina Pujas Ronan, issued a statement saying her client remains deeply saddened by the loss of life and extends his sympathy to the Shinetto family. She said Quigley has been careful not to litigate the facts publicly, but maintains the crash was an unfortunate and tragic accident, not a criminal act. Ronan said Quigley has cooperated with investigators and is confident the objective evidence will ultimately support his account of what occurred. She referenced his 17 years in law enforcement, his prior service with the Woburn and Nantucket police departments, and his deployment to Afghanistan, adding that he has never been the subject of disciplinary proceedings. We ask that the public allow the investigation to proceed fairly and without speculation, Ronan said. The Massachusetts State Police were unavailable for comment regarding the lawsuit. And you can follow Aaron Curtis on X at ASELAHCURTIS or on Blue Sky. Our next article is under the heading of Utilities. Eversource defends doubled profits as utilities bills soar, by Tim Dunn. Eversource and allied observers say the state-mandated charges and supply-side issues have contributed to high energy bills in Massachusetts, while Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey, a Democrat, says the rising rates are outrageous as the company makes money hand over fist. We know affordability remains a top concern for customers, and that's something we take seriously. More than half of a typical customer's bill is driven by supply costs and state-mandated charges that we do not control or profit from, Eversource spokeswoman Olesa Stepanova told the Herald. We also work with state leaders to provide bill credits for gas customers and supporters of Governor Healey's initiative to lower costs during a peak winter heating season, she added. The company is defending its more than doubled profits reported in 2025, a grand total of $1.69 billion compared to $812 million in earnings in 2024, as utility costs for Massachusetts ratepayers have skyrocketed and shows no sign of lowering anytime soon. The utility company says lower overall earnings in 2024 caused by $524 million loss from the selling off of its stake in Revolution Wind and South Fork Wind offshore wind projects, a non-recurring loss, account for the large increase in profits from 24 to 2025. Stepanova also says that investments in capital upgrades, most frequently to its natural gas infrastructure, also contributed to Eversource's sizable increase in profits from 2025 over 2024, adding that the company has been substantially under-earning prior to its rate change in early 2025. As part of its normal operations, Eversource typically reinvests up to 40% of its distribution system earnings back into company to help fund future capital improvements, said Stepanova. Stepanova said that early 2025 rate changes were implemented to recover costs associated with upgrades to safety and reliability, upgrades to natural gas infrastructure, saying a portion of the update took effect in late 2024. The gas company systems enhancement plan, a policy implemented by state lawmakers in 2015, has incentivized utility companies in Massachusetts to replace worn down and old pipes in other natural gas infrastructure, allowing utilities to recover the losses immediately through increased rates with a guaranteed profit. Eversource saw a 24% increase in natural gas profits in 2025, good for $360.5 million in earnings in 2025, up from $291 million in 2024. But despite this, when it comes to soaring energy bills for Massachusetts ratepayers, Eversource is pointing the finger at supply costs and state-mandated changes. We know affordability remains a top concern for customers, and that's something we take seriously. More than half of a typical customer's bill is driven by supply costs and the state-mandated charges that we do not control or profit from, said Stepanova. We also worked with state leaders to provide bill credits for gas customers and supported Massachusetts Governor Healey's initiative to lower costs during the peak winter heating season. Governor Healey's take. Democrat Governor Healey is calling Eversource profits outrageous, citing them as a reason why she is opposing rate hikes proposed by utility companies across the state. It's outrageous that the utilities are making huge profits on the backs of families and businesses paying sky-high bills. That's why I, as your governor, am opposing the rate hikes that the utilities are proposing across the state, she told the Herald. My energy bill also would subject the utilities to strict audits and ban them from passing frivolous costs like executive travel onto the ratepayers. We are working on every front to lower energy costs, taking charges off of bills, getting people a 25% reduction in their February and March electric bills, and taking an all-of-the-above approach to bringing more affordable energy into the state. This is an urgent issue. People need relief now, the governor said. Climate mandates. The Massachusetts Fiscal Alliance, like Eversource, says state climate mandates and policies are the main driver behind increased utility bills in the Bay State, specifically naming the net zero by 2050 climate mandate. The organization says Healey and state lawmakers are forcing utility companies to pass on increasing costs caused by these policies to ratepayers. Utility bills are high because of the net zero by 2050 climate mandate. The climate mandates are being set by the governor and the Democrat lawmakers in many of New England states. They are forcing utility companies to make decisions on what to spend their money on. As a result, these utility companies are forced to pass along the cost to the ratepayers, and they are also making profits in order to fund these climate projects, said Mask Fiscal Executive Director Paul Craney. It's important for the public to understand the blame falls on the politicians forcing the hand of the utility companies. If this was a screw, you wouldn't blame the screw for turning. Rather, you would blame the hand that turns the screwdriver, that turns the screw. These high utility bills are a direct result of the climate mandates our elected officials are forcing the utility companies into, he said. As gas and other utility bills in Massachusetts remain among the highest in the nation, state legislature has taken no action to repeal gas system improvement plans and has yet to implement any substantial or effective policies to combat soaring energy bills. And now under the heading of Massachusetts state politics, your attorney general represents the lawmakers against the citizenry and an auditor DeSoglio in the audit lawsuit by Lance Reynolds. The Massachusetts Attorney General's office is representing House Speaker Democrat Ron Mariano and Senate President Democrat Karen Spilker as they look to dismiss the state auditor's lawsuit against them, a move that the state auditor describes as insanity. DeSoglio is speaking out after Attorney General's office wrote letters to the state Supreme Judicial Court on behalf of the top Beacon Hill Democrat lawmakers requesting dismissal of the lawsuit amid the auditor's fight to enforce the voter-approved audit of the legislature. Attorney General Andrea Campbell has also filed a motion to strike the complaint, which DeSoglio filed against the legislature last week, escalating the feud that has rattled Beacon Hill since November of 2024, when 72% of the state's voters approved the audit. DeSoglio, a Methuen Democrat seeking re-election, has called out the AG's office, posting on social media a copy of a letter that Assistant Attorney General Ann Sturman wrote to the SJC on Thursday on behalf of Mariano. Can't make it up, the auditor stated on Friday. The AG still claims she supports the audit. Please believe your own eyes. Her office is representing the Democrat speaker, not us. In the request for the state's highest court to dismiss the lawsuit, Sturman wrote, the House concurs with the arguments set forth by the Attorney General in her motion to strike and does not believe this matter is appropriately before the court. The Attorney General's office confirmed to the Herald that it also sent a letter to the state's highest court requesting the same on behalf of Spilka. It added that per state law and a long-standing legal precedent, the Attorney General is the only official authorized to represent state agencies and officials in court and initiate lawsuits like the one the auditor has filed. The AGO remains ready to move this issue forward, the office said, but any lawsuit filed by a state agency or official must follow these requirements set forth in the state constitution. In response to a comment on her ex post, DeSoglio said she's not surprised at all that the attorney general is defending the speaker. Rather, the auditor slammed Campbell for previously highlighting her efforts in voting for the audit. I'm surprised anyone in their right mind allows her to state that she supports the audit and just needs more information. No, DeSoglio stated of the AG, she's legitimately working against the case on behalf of the speaker in plain print. Insanity. In her lawsuit, State Auditor DeSoglio asked for the SJC to force Mariano Spilker and the clerks of both legislative branches to turn over previous financial audits, settlement agreements, budgets, and monetary transactions. The auditor also request that the SJC allow her to appoint outside counsel selected by her office to represent them as a special assistant attorney general. Shannon Liss-Royden, who lost against Campbell in the 2022 Democrat primary for AG, would receive the nod if so. We are being blocked from the courts by a hostile attorney general whose office is fighting against us, quite literally, on behalf of the speaker, DeSoglio said in a statement shared with the Herald on Friday evening. The attorney general has a duty to act in the public interest, but instead has acted in the speaker's interest. The attorney general's office told the Herald that DeSoglio must answer the questions that it has repeatedly asked her for it to authorize the lawsuit and Liss-Royden appointment as special assistant attorney general. The office says some of the questions DeSoglio has failed to answer, including to what extent she believes the state constitution limits her authority to audit the legislature, and to what extent the auditor attempted to negotiate with the legislature before initial litigation. These are the types of questions that every other state official and state agency answer in the usual course when they seek to litigate. The Attorney General's office said, the answer to these questions is critical. Unless the AGO knows the auditor's position on whether constitutional limitations apply, it added, it cannot decide whether to represent her, file separate, or represent the legislature. The Attorney General argues that DeSoglio is failing to assert a legal claim in filing a lawsuit. By statute, the Attorney General is a gatekeeper empowered to determine when, if ever, the Commonwealth's intergovernmental legal disputes require judicial resolution. Attorney General Campbell wrote in her motion to strike, there would be no gate at all were mere disagreements with the Attorney General sufficient basis for a dissenting state official to initiate a lawsuit. Mariano has declined to comment on the lawsuit, referring the Herald to his past statements regarding the legislative audit. The House Speaker suggested last March that the auditor, DeSoglio, was making the audit personal. We have dealt with the personal attacks and the tweets and the comments, Mariano said, when asked if DeSoglio should recuse herself from any legislative audits. DeSoglio has argued that her status as an elected official provides enough protection for an independent probe. Democrat lawmakers, though, counter that the auditor violates the state's constitution's separation of powers. 72% of the voters mandated the audit law, DeSoglio said in her statement shared with the Herald, and the courts need to settle this matter. The people deserve an answer. By opposing the public interest on this matter, Attorney General Campbell has abdicated her responsibility as our chief law enforcement officer. We are absolutely going to fight her attempt to block us. Turning to our next article, taxpayers pay the price for blatant fraud, yet they're left in the dark. And so farewell then, Dana Pullman and Bill DeSapps, felonious fraudsters finally off to their federal prison cells after years and years of foot-dragging through the courts. They are both criminals of the types that have become all too familiar to Massachusetts taxpayers. Pullman was a thug state trooper and corrupt union boss. DeSapps is a Haitian-born welfare grifter who absconded with almost $1 million in federal COVID relief funds. After their recent sentencing, 64-year-old Pullman is gone for 3 years. And 49-year-old DeSapps will do 2 years, hopefully followed by a rapid denaturalization in deportation back to his savage third-world homeland. Yet, as they depart to Club Fed, many questions remain unanswered about their sordid criminal careers. I was hoping for answers in their respective pre-sentencing memos, but sadly, some of their atrocious deeds will apparently remain unsolved mysteries. For instance, when DeSaps was lugged, the feds mentioned some of the luxuries he splurged on besides that $750,000 suburban home purchased in the name of a straw buyer. Specifically, as soon as he pocketed his phony $836,000 PPP COVID payout, the Haitian brought himself a gold Rolls Royce, paying to an old stereotypical much there bill. And then DeSaps went down to West Virginia and paid $32,000 cash for 5 French bulldogs, the ultimate designer dog these days. Your taxpayer dollars at work. DeSaps' ill-gotten Rolls was mentioned only in passing in the Fed's memo to the judge, and the Frenchies not at all. What happened to the poor dogs? Have they been rehomed to Vermont with the McAlbert's dog Chloe / Cora? Or were they perhaps adopted by some of the beautiful people who favor the fashionable breed like Lady Gaga or AOC? But as a true crime fan, I have even more questions about crooked state cop Pullman and his domestic arrangements. Back in the day, believe it or not, Pullman seemed to have been a real chick magnet. Must have been those matinee idol good looks of his, as shown in this photograph that the U.S. attorney thoughtfully included in the pre-sentencing memo. A snapshot, taken in happier, stealing times, is with his co-defendant, Ann Lynch, now age 75, that wrinkly lobbyist will be spending the next 15 months in a federal penitentiary. And that was Howie Carr. And from the Politicians in Politics section of the Herald, A.G. Campbell ditches X due to, quote, hate and disinformation. By Lance Reynolds, A.G. Rhea Campbell is leaving X, a social media platform that she claims promotes hate, disinformation, and the exploitation of our kids. Campbell has announced that she is ditching accounts for her office and personal use, inviting followers to find her and the Attorney General's office on other platforms, including Blue Sky, Threads, Facebook, and Instagram. X has sadly become an app and platform with no accountability and no guardrails, the Attorney General claimed in a video posted on her account Saturday. Hate, disinformation, and the exploitation of our children is on the rise. And you saw recently AI tools on X being used to promote sexualized image of folks, including minors, our children. I can no longer be part of that. As Attorney General, I'm taking on companies and social media platforms that are not responsible, that are putting profit ahead of our children and above them, Campbell added. This is an opportunity to stand up and do our part to hold everyone accountable who is harming our kids, and most importantly, to have responsible technology. Critics of the Attorney General are slamming her for leaving X, arguing that Campbell is hiding away from their criticism, particularly around her fight with State Auditor Diana DeSoglio over the voter-approved audit of the legislature. DeSoglio commented on the AG's office post stating, quote, "See you and House Speaker at Ron Mariano in court," unquote. The auditor has sued Mariano and State President Karen Spilker for refusing to comply with the legislative audit, which 72% of all voters approved in November of 2024. Paul Diego Craney, executive director of the Watchdog Massachusetts Fiscal Alliance, added, "Protecting politicians and running from the voters checks out." Campbell is not the only elected official in the Bay State who has ditched X. The Attorney General joins Boston Mayor Michelle Wu in getting rid of her platform after President Trump won re-election in November of 2024. Blue Sky gained 1 million new users in the week after the president won the second term, as some ex-users, mostly liberals, looked for an alternative platform to post their thoughts and engage with others like them online. An abrupt end to political newsletter serving Massachusetts. The last edition of Politico's Massachusetts Playbook came out on Friday as its editors advertised how the news outlet will continue covering politics and policy in Washington and elsewhere. They did not state the reasons behind the newsletter's end in the Bay State. Playbook author, reporter Kelly Garrity broke the development. Today is also the last edition of Mass Playbook, Garrity stated in a newsletter while announcing that she will be leaving Politico to join the Boston Globe. Thank you, Times, and million to everyone who ever read, emailed, sent a tip, answered a late-night call, email, text, or submitted a birthday. I was a huge fan of this newsletter before I started at Politico, Garrity asked, and I feel so lucky to have had the chance to write it. The development caught the attention of Massachusetts Congressman Richard Neal, who called the decision misguided. For many years, the dedicated journalists of Politico have played an important role in delivering timely, reliable information across the Commonwealth. The Springfield Democrat stated that an ex post on Saturday, while the decision by Politico to end Mass Playbook is misguided, I thank the many reporters and editors whose commitment to the facts through the years have helped keep Massachusetts readers informed on the issues that matter most. End of article. Sports. The Boston Red Sox Notebook. Anthony is excited to set tone as the leadoff hitter. By Gabriel Starr. Fort Myers, Florida, an important piece of the puzzle that is the 2026 Red Sox, was put into place Saturday morning when manager Alex Cora named Roman Anthony the leadoff hitter. Anthony impressed overall in his 71-game rookie season last year, but he proved an especially strong table setter. He made 27 starts at the top of the lineup, 31 games total, and hit .336, got on base at a .439 on-base clip, and slugged .564 with 26 runs and 17 RBI. He collected 37 hits, including 5 doubles, a triple, and 6 home runs. He drew 19 walks and struck out 34 times. As of the first at-bat of games, specifically, Anthony went 8 for 25 with 2 home runs, a walk, and 7 strikeouts. I felt really comfortable in the leadoff spot last year, Anthony said. I think it's something for me that I take with a lot of pride, getting the boys going and trying to get on base. Anthony will celebrate his 22nd birthday on May 13th. Rarely is a player so young handed such an important role. The most recent Red Sox leadoff hitters younger than 22 besides Anthony last season were Jonathan Arruz in 2020 and Mookie Betts in 2014. Other notable 21 and younger Red Sox who hit leadoff include Dwight Evans, Tony Conigliaro, and Bobby Doerr. Though it doesn't happen often, in franchise history, the most games in a leadoff spot by a hitter younger than 22 were Doerr's 86 in 1937 and Anthony's 31, 27 starts, already ranked fourth in franchise history. According to Stathead, only 5 players younger than 22 have spent more than 100 games in the leadoff spot in single or cumulative seasons since 2000, Carl Crawford, Elvis Andrews, Mike Trout, Ronald Acuna Jr., and Jackson Holliday. Cora pointed to Mookie Betts as examples of power hitters who found success in the role. George Springer, Mookie Betts, the manager said, they've done it before, setting the tempo. Kyle Schwarber, too. It can be a 1-0 very quick, and it's a quality at bat. If you can do some damage in the first inning or just score some runs, Anthony said, I think that's huge in a baseball game, kind of changing the momentum. It's a huge at-bat, not one that I ever take for granted, so I'm looking forward to it. The Comeback Kids. The Red Sox came from behind to defeat the Minnesota Twins 7-2 in their first Grapefruit League game of 2026 on Saturday at Lee's Health Sports Complex. Peyton Toll made his Red Sox spring training debut, not something that typically happens after a player has already made not only their Major League Baseball debut, but their postseason debut as well. But Toll, who wasn't in big league camp last year, can now say he's checked every debut box. He started the last two innings, in which he struck out one batter, and the only damage was a solo home run to Rice Lewis. He did good, Cora said. He made some pitches. Velocity was okay. He threw strikes. That's what we wanted to see today. Toll wasn't as pleased with his performance, though. He feels some of his off-speed pitches are getting closer to where he wants them to be. It was kind of like, I mean, obviously unhappy, he said. Didn't feel like I had the 2K kill. What I wanted to, especially with Lewis, trying to get a ball up there and in. It just was in the honey hole. Obviously, that ball was hit very hard, and the bat kept ringing a little bit in my head, but it happens. Though I responded well, I was able to come back and get three outs. The Twins took an immediate 1-0 lead, doubled it when Lewis singled to drive in Luke Keskal in the fourth. They held the Boston Red Sox scoreless until the top of the fifth, when things began to unravel. Boston scored three runs apiece in the seventh and the ninth, while the Twins made four errors in the contest. Andrew Monasterio hit the first Red Sox home run of Grapefruit League play to get Boston on the board, and shortstop prospect Mike Romero's RBI single in the seventh put them in front for good. Romero's knock followed a double by Christian Campbell, who impressed at the plate for the second day in a row. Sam Manajero scratched. Tyler Semenegiro was due to make his Red Sox debut Saturday, but was scratched due to back tightness, Cora said. He should be fine. He wasn't the only one. Twin starter Joe Ryan was scratched less than 20 minutes before the first pitch due to lower back tightness on his right side. Probable pitchers, right-handed Brayan Bello, is scheduled to start today against the Toronto Blue Jays, the first Red Sox spring training home game at JetBlue Park. Probable pitchers to follow are Garrett Whitlock, Giovanni Morin, Greg Weissert, Treon Guerrero, and Devin Sweet. Around the league, the New York Yankees are dealing with a stinky spring training situation after a sewage leak penetrated their clubhouse and outer hallway and created pools of fetid water around George Steinbrenner Stadium, impacting areas which include the lower level of their team store, had to be closed or cordoned off. The Athletic reported an area of one stadium entrance was torn up so pipes could be accessed. Hall of Famer and Pittsburgh Pirates legend Bill Mazeroski passed away Friday at 89 years old. An 8-time Gold Glove second baseman, 10-time All-Star, and 2-time World Series champion, Mazeroski made history in the 1960 World Series between the Pirates and the Yankees as the first and to date only player to ever lead his team to victory with a Game 7 walk-off home run. And that's all we have time for today, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for listening, and we hope to see you back here again next week.